May it please the court, I'm Sylvia Royce, appearing here today on behalf of appellant David A. Duvall as appointed counsel. We have raised two issues in our briefs. They are separate issues, although there is some factual association between the two in that when you have a situation in which you have a counsel such as Harry Tun, who was not candid with the court, and this touched off a whole series of difficulties, then there is some continuity here. But the first issue I would submit is a very easy one, in that the distinguished district court judge utterly failed to go through any of the inquiries to consider any of the factors relating to a continuance.
Can I just ask you about this? This may be a little inappropriate, but I'm asking about what the strategic sense of this argument is. If you win, the plea bargain will be vacated, and he will be faced with mandatory life if he goes to trial, correct?
If he were to go to trial, yes, well, Your Honor.
And given the description of the government's evidence in its brief, the government doesn't seem to have any reason not to go to trial with him. So. And he seemed desperate to get the plea. In the transcript, he seemed desperate to get to a plea here and not to risk life. If you win, you risk life.
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because we've asked for two forms of relief.
Well, on the first one, if you win the first one, the second one is irrelevant.
No, sir.
Why not? That's what I'm not understanding.
Because the relief we're asking for is a remand to the district court to allow an opportunity to develop the record as to whether Duvall could have and could now retain new counsel.
To what end?
Well, then new counsel.
To obtain a setting aside of the plea?
New counsel would then have an opportunity to review all of the evidence, which I suggest may have been treated in a very summary way by his prior counsel, and to decide whether it makes sense to go to trial in the case. There has been an intervening case, Antoine Jones, and at least some of the evidence against Mr. Duvall would fall in a retrial. There would not be evidence of a GPS that was attached to his car. None of this is in the record, but in an attempt to answer Judge Garland's question. But, Your Honor,
how would the GPS attached to Jones's car help here? There'd be a standing problem.
It was attached to Duvall's car, Your Honor, when he went to North Carolina, and that. The evidence in the case is very complex. It is possible that it would not be prudent to go to trial, but it would certainly seem.
You've said enough to make it clear to me that there's a reason why you're arguing this that I didn't understand. That's all that's really necessary.
Thank you.
So now on to the question. Your argument is that you have a constitutional right to counsel of your choice.
Correct.
But I don't actually read him as objecting in any way to the counsel he was given, or insisting or even asking that he wants to pay for counsel of his own choice. He says he wants to retain an effective counsel. The judge gives him somebody who, as far as we know, is a perfectly effective counsel, and he gives it to him for free. I don't see him making the request that you're making on appeal.
He does make it in his letter, Your Honor. He specifically asked the district court judge for a continuance so that he would have a chance to retain effective counsel. So
That's after saying he can't afford it, right?
I'm sorry?
That's after saying he can't afford it.
Well, part of what we're dealing with here is a very, very spotty record in which Duvall is cut off at every turn, in which bench conferences are held out of his hearing, and then he is presented with the fait accompli of an appointed counsel. It's very hard to know exactly what his position was all along, but when we look at the record, what the district court court judge says is, you have any more money? And Duvall says, no, which could either mean, no, I don't have any more money, or it could mean, no, my family doesn't have any more money, because what he goes on to say is, my family got that money together. And so we don't know if we were to go back to the district court and have a chance to develop the record to see whether he actually is in a position, was in a position to retain new counsel, whether we would then be in a position to go to trial.
You don't even know whether he was asking for to pick counsel of choice rather than to have appointed counsel. When he says he doesn't have any money, the judge says, all right, he asked for a continuance to get a new lawyer. Instead of a continuance, the judge gives him a new lawyer immediately. And when he asks whether he has any problem with that, the defendant says, well, I just want to be sure that I can keep this plea bargain if I want it.
That's
and the judge says, fine, okay, you can. I promise you, you can keep the plea bargain if you want it. And the judge says, any questions, comments, arguments, objections? The argument that you're making now, which is a sophisticated argument, which is that I want a specific counsel and I didn't get that one, or I want a chance to look for a specific counsel, I don't see any reason why the judge should have thought that that was the argument he was making there, other than that he didn't like who he had and he wanted an effective counsel.
You're quite correct so far as that position goes. The difficulty with your position, Your Honor, if I may say so,
not my position, I'm using it as an argument point for you to respond to,
is that the district court was really obliged to grant at least a short continuance so that everyone would have an opportunity to regroup and think this over, so that Duvall would have an opportunity to see whether additional counsel could be retained with the funds that he would have or that he did have.
He didn't have to, he didn't plead right. I mean, he wasn't sentenced or anything right then, right?
At that point, he was not,
Your Honor. Just given a new counsel.
He had entered his guilty plea.
Right.
In the course of the guilty plea, the district court judge had asked him if he was satisfied with the services of his lawyer or words to that effect. And he said, no,
right,
basically, I'm not satisfied. He never understood why he was susceptible to life in prison.
How long was it after this proceeding in which he's given new counsel, May 3rd, and the time he's actually sentenced?
It would have been approximately 4 months. I believe he was sentenced in September.
Right. So any time during that 4 months, he could have said again to the judge, I want to name my own counsel. I don't want this counsel.
He could have done so, Your Honor.
And he didn't.
And he did not.
So why isn't that effectively the same as a continuance? He's given another counsel. Nothing happens during the rest. For 4 more months, nothing happens. And if he doesn't like it, he has obviously shown that he's not shy about complaining about a counsel's not effective.
He is not shy about complaining that counsel is not effective, but he has no idea what the legal standards are. He has no idea what his alternatives are. He goes to sentencing, I believe, still not understanding.
Any argument that the counsel who he had at sentencing was ineffective?
None whatsoever, Your Honor. But that isn't really the test under the Supreme Court law when you're looking at a situation in which retained counsel was not allowed to proceed or did not proceed.
Right, but in that case, Gonzalez, you're talking about, that's a case where he had a specific counsel in mind. He wanted that counsel. He repeatedly asked for that counsel, and the judge repeatedly brushed him away.
Well, Mr. Duvall may have had specific counsel in mind, too. We don't know that based upon our record. But the
Do
real
you know that now?
It's not in the record, Your Honor. I know who he had in mind, if that's the court's question, but it is not part of the record. But the real difficulty, it seems to me, here is the way the district court judge handled it, and I don't think the court wants to countenance a situation in which, even with the very best of motives, the responsibility for representing a criminal defendant who has the means to hire counsel is instead foisted off on the taxpayers in the interests of sort of expediting the matter of kind of moving the case along,
yeah,
and I think that's what happened.
Whatever we're doing here, I don't think we're protecting the taxpayers' interest. I don't think that's our job at all.
And you don't really think that's our job at all either. Our job isn't to worry about whether the taxpayers pay more or less or anything like that. Your argument is that if he had a specific counsel, that he was entitled to the specific counsel.
Not exactly, Your Honor. That is part of it, but it also has to do with the right to have counsel of one's choice, which is really an unqualified right so long as one can pay for it. And my other criticism really relates to the way the district court judge handled it. This circuit has been very clear about the fact that although the right to a continuance is by no means absolute and it's entirely discretionary with the district court judge, the court's prior cases have been very clear that there are a series of factors that have to be considered before the court grants or denies a continuance.
This is a continuance for what?
A continuance.
So usually a continuance is before the trial starts, I want more time, so I get a new lawyer and the lawyer has time to prepare for the trial. Or before my sentencing, I want a new lawyer and I want a continuance in order to get that new lawyer for the new lawyer to get up to speed. But the thing that happens here happens 4 months later. It's the sentencing. And he had 4 months in which to do that. So the reason for a continuance, I don't see what the issue is. If he didn't like what happened, at any point he could have asked for more time. He could have hired a lawyer and replaced him. And replaced the, who was the court-appointed attorney?
John Carney.
Right.
John
so he could have replaced Carney at any
he
moment.
Could have.
Unless there's some argument, which has not been made, that Carney overbore Duvall's will or something like that, I don't see what a continuance, well, he didn't effectively have a continuance, but even better, he had a continuance with a lawyer during the period if he couldn't find somebody else. The judge didn't prohibit him from hiring somebody.
It's correct, Your Honor. Perhaps it would be well for me to switch to our other argument, since there may also be questions about that.
If we follow the First and Ninth Circuit's approach, this plea post-Freeman, this plea agreement doesn't meet what you need it to say, right?
I'm not sure that's correct, Your Honor, because in this case, Mr. Duvall fell in criminal history category number one. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that that was true in either of the other cases. In both cases, there's no suggestion that the defendant would have fallen in criminal history category one. And that's pretty clear from this fact.
The plea agreement that will satisfy Justice Sotomayor's second category would be a plea agreement that referred to the offense level and the criminal history category.
Well, it's true that
you don't have to agree with those cases. I'm just trying to tease out. I think you would be walking us into a circuit split, which is fine, but I just want to do that with eyes open.
It is correct that the plea that was before the Supreme Court in Freeman did give a criminal history category,
right,
and did give an offense level. Mm-hmm. But that isn't exactly what Justice Sotomayor is talking about there. She is saying that the plea agreement really has to contain evidence from which you can conclude.
Well, it says explicit, right? Explicit, express, she says over and over again, words to that effect.
She does, but she is criticized by the eight other members of the court because that isn't really quite what she has done there. She has instead looked at the situation and inferred what the sentence would have been on the crack cocaine portion of Freeman's sentence.
She does have...
She rejects the criticism.
...points that indicate a guideline range, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
She has two discrete data points from which one can unambiguously infer a sentencing range.
Well,
I think it's
yes.
16 and 1, I forget.
Anyway, yes.
19 and 1.
It's 19 and 4, actually.
19 and 4, okay. In any event, there are data points from which a range follows.
That is true. That is true. But it seems to me that something very close to that was present here, because we know what the offense level was. That's the amount of relevant conduct.
But Justice Sotomayor seems to make it all turn on the words in the plea agreement.
She mostly makes it turn on the words of the plea agreement, and indeed, that is very...
Do you see something in her opinion that allows one to go beyond the plea agreement?
Well, she says that you can't, but in fact, what she does is she divines that that 46
yeah, but
month...
the divination process is comparatively simple in that case.
It is, Your Honor.
But your point is that there is a divination process.
That's right. That is exactly right.
It wasn't squarely within the text of the agreement. She did some inferential reasoning.
That's right. And what she is rejecting is the idea that a defendant with an 11C1C plea would be eligible for a crack cocaine reduction merely because the district court judge had calculated the sentencing guidelines at the sentencing. She says that doesn't matter. And she says she doesn't want any sort of archaeological dig, I think one of the circuits called it, into the negotiating history of the parties. Well, what we have here is neither of those. You can look simply at the documents that were filed.
If I look only at the plea with respect to the criminal history, it says your client understands that if your client has two or more convictions for a crime of violence or felony drug offense, your client will be subject to the substantially higher guideline penalties provided for the career offender statutes and provisions.
That's right? Correct. And well, he did not. And
well, but that's
and the
not,
government
we don't know,
knew that.
Well, that's not what it says in here. In fact, the only sentence that seems likely that's actually expressed here is the risk of life.
I don't think that they counsel him anywhere in that plea agreement that he is liable for a sentence of life. They mention the career offender guidelines, which are completely different than the mandatory minimums. They don't speak anywhere to the mandatory minimum, which is the sentence he would actually have been facing.
Well, they couldn't know for certain anyway how the judge would have ruled on a safety valve claim.
Well, that's correct, but I'd respectfully submit that that doesn't really have anything to do with determining where he falls on the sentencing table. In determining whether he is eligible for a sentencing reduction, one is going to look at the offense level and at the criminal history category, and that is what's going to determine the starting
you're
point.
You're drawing the distinction between a guidelines range and a guidelines sentence.
Yes, sir.
I understand that, but I'm a little puzzled that you seem to take no interest in the safety valve.
Well, it does become part of the calculus on a remand for resentencing, because there that's going to be the point of departure. The district court judge, in fact, did grant the safety valve reduction, although he says in his memorandum opinion that he did not. He finds in his statement of reasons that Duvall is actually at a level 29 criminal history category 1. So that becomes the point of departure for a crack cocaine reduction.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's the reference to 29, but that's the guidelines range before application of the mandatory minimum, right?
Yes, sir.
The question you raise about 5G11 is very interesting, but I'm not sure that once you have a sentencing, let's see, what's the magic word? A guideline sentence. Once you have a guideline sentence under 5G11, I'm not sure that there's anything left of the guidelines range.
Well, with respect, there is. The guidelines range is determined earlier in a proper proceeding of sentencing. And then the Chapter 5 adjustments are made after that guideline range has been established. What the Sentencing Commission has written is that the mandatory minimum then becomes the guidelines sentence.
Right.
But it does not become the guideline range. The Sentencing Commission does not say so, and it does not make any sense for that to be the fact. I mean, a range
Can I ask? I'm confused.
Go ahead. If we try to pursue how far Justice Sotomayor would go, or it's not what she would do, it's what the words she used in her opinion mean. It is, I think, probably undisputed that if you set aside the mandatory minimum bit, one can infer from the record as a whole, with a certain amount of delving beyond the plea agreement, that you have 29 as the magic number. But wouldn't her, well, two things. First place, do we have any reason to think that the 168 months is based on that, in the sense that Justice Sotomayor uses the term? My recollection is the range for 29 turns out to be completely lower than 168.
Well, yes, Your Honor, because
so something else is at work.
That's right. The 29, the intersection at 21 and criminal history category 1 occurs after the other adjustments are made. The base offense level is 34 at criminal history 1. The total offense level is 29 at criminal history 1. But I've lost the train of your question.
The problem was that once we have what is in a sense the applicable guideline range, a range which in at least sort of for openers is what the sentence was based on, then we find that the number of months they'd agreed on is above the maximum of that. So it seems hard to regard that as satisfying Justice Sotomayor.
I'm not sure I understand your question, but it is the base offense level that is going to govern eligibility for a crack cocaine reduction, and it is the total offense level, which happens after you've made these adjustments for safety valve, for acceptance of responsibility, for role in the offense, which was not present in this case. You know, the up and downs that happen after a base offense level is established. Whatever that number is, that then becomes the point of departure for the actual reduction, if any.
I understand
any.
That.
But you're
just trying to figure out what would satisfy Justice Sotomayor's opinion, and it's hard for me to imagine. Let's even assume that the plea agreement specifically alludes to 29, right? That's the adjusted offense level.
It could, yes. Let's suppose it had.
Yet the agreement also speaks of 180 months. In fact, it's 168. But those are both above the maximum. So how is a judge dutifully following Justice Sotomayor to find that the sentence was based on that guidelines range?
Oh, I see the court's point. I haven't thought of that before, but it seems to me that Justice Sotomayor would look at that situation, and she would look at not only the total offense level but also the base offense level, and because that's what's going to determine eligibility. And I think,
but here that doesn't help you, right? Sorry to interrupt, because that was higher, right? Are we talking about the 34 coming down to 29?
Well, yes, 34 is...
Okay, that does help you then.
Yes. But, you know, the parties can agree on anything in an 11C1C
plea. I know, but under Justice Sotomayor's view, the way they express it is absolutely critical.
Yeah.
Well, it's not only the way they express it, but it has to be the relationship to the possible sentences within, yes, within that particular sentencing context. And here, I think Justice Sotomayor would have to look at the base offense level, at the level 34, and I think the fact that the sentence actually did fall, the sentence actually did fall within base offense level 34, at criminal history category 1, both the sentence as it appeared in the written plea agreement and the sentence as amended by the prosecutor and accepted by the defendant at sentencing, both of those fall within that range.
So you're saying the base offense, it fell within the base offense level range at criminal history 1, even though it wouldn't have been the final offense level range?
That is correct.
And that's can be inferred, or that's indicated by the plea agreement?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or evident from, to use another formulation, from the concurrence?
Yes. Yes, I think that's correct. My time has been up.
I'd like to ask you, well...
No, go ahead.
You rest your entire argument on the apparent premise that Justice Sotomayor's opinion is controlling.
That's correct.
Have you ever read our decision in King versus Palmer?
Yes, Your Honor, I have, and I have struggled with that, but as one goes to write a brief, you know, the cases that were coming out from the other circuits were fairly clear.
The cases where this court disagreed with all the other circuits. There have been cases where dissenting judges on this court disagreed with all the other circuits.
That's correct.
The Supreme Court went along with them.
That is correct, and certainly my case is much, much easier if it is the plurality that governs, or if the court takes the position that it is actually neither quite the plurality nor Justice Sotomayor's.
Well, that's true. That's true. Presumably, following King versus Palmer, none of the three opinions in the Supreme Court is controlling, and we forge ahead on our own.
And I think that's an utterly correct approach, and one that happens to benefit my client enormously. It was simply a question, as his counsel, to figure out how I was going to write the brief. And
well, not if we went with the chief's approach.
What?
Not if we went with the dissent's approach. That wouldn't help you.
Well, that would not have been beneficial to my client,
exactly.
Your Honor.
It's not clear to me that you benefit from the other four, because their view is just that the guidelines have to be consulted in the regular course in every case.
That's right.
And if you consulted the guidelines in the regular course in this case, you would see that the person will be sentenced to life.
No, sir, you would not.
Well, I'm not following that.
Well, it would be, the life would have been the guideline sentence, mm-hmm, but for the 11C1C plea, but it's going to be...
Subject to the safety valve.
Correct.
But all they're saying is, they're not asking you to calculate any specific guidelines in that one. They're just saying that the guidelines underlie everything.
Correct.
And in this case, there's a section of the guidelines, 5G, which underlies this and which tells you this person gets life. If that's all they care about, if they don't care anything about the intent of the parties, which the first four do not, then I'm not sure that you get anywhere from this. But since both sides have agreed to follow Justice Sotomayor, I don't think we have to press this more, but I do have a question about this. So you appear to be arguing that the mandatory minimum cannot affect the based on a sentencing range that has been lowered provision. Is that right?
Well,
because life isn't a sentencing range, is that the idea?
That's right. It's not a range. There's no, a range has an upper and a lower.
Well,
a
so,
mandatory minimum is not a range.
Well, that means if Duval had not pled, but instead he had been tried and sentenced to life, could he get a reduction because the crack cocaine guidelines were reduced?
Absolutely not. Not under any of the circuit law that I'm familiar with.
Why not? What is the sentencing range? Hasn't he been sentenced based on your theory, based on a sentencing range that's been lowered, although then altered also by 5G?
Well, that's not the case that we have before us.
I know. I'm trying to figure out, though. I mean, it seems to me that if the argument is that life can't be the range, that is life to life, then we have the odd situation where that would suggest that when the crack guidelines are lowered, the person is eligible for reduction, even though he's stuck with life.
I think that is probably what the plurality would hold, because their overall overarching position is that the guidelines inform every single sentencing decision, every single negotiation over sentences, and every single proceeding having to do with a criminal case at all. And I think that's correct. And perhaps the plurality, if we were to catapult ourselves immediately into the Supreme Court with that sort of hypothetical, perhaps the plurality would take the position that person is eligible for the sort of limited crack cocaine reduction you get. I was simply speaking to my understanding of the law in this circuit and in other circuits, that it would, the case law is fairly unanimous in the circuits, at least.
Well, why would Congress have wanted to reduce someone's sentence because the crack guidelines were reduced when the purpose of the sentence, according to the Congress, had nothing to do with the crack guidelines, had only to do with the mandatory minimum, which they didn't change, and which the Sentencing Commission obviously hasn't changed.
Well, there's always a difficulty in arguing that a sentence that's based on an act of Congress needs to be ignored. That's always a serious difficulty, obviously. But the problem with the crack cocaine sentences has been so widely understood to be racially discriminatory, to be based on scholarship and
I understand that. I understand that argument, but what I don't I mean, if he went to trial today,
yes, sir,
and he were convicted, he would get life, correct?
Correct.
Regardless of any changes in the crack guidelines.
Correct.
So why should he have a different sentence because he was, imagine he were, because he pled or was convicted several years ago, before the crack guidelines were changed, when the crack guidelines has no consequence for, I mean, why should he be better off than a person who's convicted today of exactly the same crime under the current guidelines?
Well, that happens all the time, Your Honor. I'm not sure that I exactly understand your question, but if you're asking me whether he should have been eligible for a crack cocaine reduction had he been convicted at trial and sentenced to life either several years ago or today, I'd have to say that under the cases in this circuit and others, he is not eligible. But we make differences all the time between what is likely to happen at trial and what result would be compelled by a sentencing following a trial, and by and with the sentences that
following
are given yeah. following a plea. It's our system is permeated with that from start to finish with every case. A plea makes everything possible. A conviction following a trial severely, severely restricts both the parties and the district court judge.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, Stratton Strand on behalf of the government. Two quick record corrections on the denial of continuance issue. The government had a warrant for the GPS on the car, and that was provided in discovery.
This is all extra record on both sides.
I just to correct the extra record representations that have been made.
You can be sure we're not going to be relying on
okay.
the record that's not before us, regardless of which side gives it to us. Ms. Royce only gave it because I asked.
Agreed, and I only gave it because it got raised.
I got it.
Judge Robertson did not abuse his discretion, let alone plainly so, in appointing appellant counsel rather than granting a continuance when appellant requested the court's help in making certain that he was awarded just representation. That was the request. As this court has instructed in Gantt, in deciding whether the district court abused its discretion in denying a request for continuance, the appellate court must assess the reasons presented to the trial judge at the time that the request is denied. Here the request was, Your Honor, I don't trust the plea advice that Messrs. Valarezo and Tan are giving me. Get me just representation so that I can trust the advice of my lawyer. The court sua sponte held a status conference on May 3rd to address appellant's concern. The court ascertained from appellant that he did not, in fact, have the money to retain his own counsel. Accordingly, the court said, well, then I'm inclined to appoint you counsel so that you can get advice from somebody that you trust. Appellant's response to that was, thank you, Your Honor, I appreciate it. And at the end of the status conference, the court concluded by assuring appellant, we haven't changed anything except we're going to get you a new lawyer for you to talk to. And appellant replied, all right. Here the court did specifically addressed the basis for the appellant's concern, his request for a continuance, fully addressed it in a way that was effective. He was, in fact, provided what appellant acknowledges was competent and zealous counsel, who reviewed the situation and determined that the advice to take the plea was good. So there was no abuse of discretion, there was no plain abuse of discretion, and certainly there was no miscarriage of justice here. If I could turn to the sentencing question, assuming both parties have assumed that Justice Sotomayor's opinion controls, and we believe that is the correct interpretation.
There are cases where the Supreme Court says that the court need not accept,
of course,
legal assumptions by both parties.
Of course. The court is not required to accept that concession, and I'm prepared to address whether Sotomayor's opinion should control if Your Honor would like me to do so.
Well, tell me how it can possibly satisfy King versus Palmer. I mean, it seems to me that requires that there be what we would follow is some common analytical thread of the opinions that are being patched together. And as far as I can make out, the one thing that's clear about Justice Sotomayor's opinion is that it has no analytical thread in common with any other justice.
King versus Palmer requires the one opinion in question be a logical subset of the five members. Here, Justice Sotomayor's opinion is in fact a logical subset of the five members.
Subset.
Because in any case in which the C agreement expressly uses a particular guideline range to establish the stipulated sentence, that range necessarily will be, as the plurality would put it, quote, a relevant part of the analytical framework the judge used to determine the sentence or approve the agreement. So there is no case in which Justice Sotomayor would find eligibility that the plurality would not.
Let's assume that's true, and I'm not sure it actually is. But if it is true, that still doesn't create any analytical link between the two opinions, does it?
It is a position. King versus Palmer said that the position has to be one at least implicitly approved by the other four. And this position is implicitly approved as to its result, because those four justices would agree that the sentencing judge in the situation where
Does King versus Palmer say implicitly approved as to result?
That may be something that I added. but
I
it is
so.
A position, it is a result. This was a result that the court reached. Justice Sotomayor's result is a result that the other four members implicitly accept, that where the plea agreement specifically sets a sentencing range in order to establish the stipulated sentence, the court the judge, in imposing that sentence, necessarily will rely on that sentence in imposing its own, in accepting that sentence and imposing it. And I would note on this subject that since we filed our brief, there have been two other circuits that have in published opinions said that they consider Justice Sotomayor as a controlling opinion. Those are U.S. versus Dixon from the Seventh Circuit and United States versus Thompson from the Third Circuit. And Thompson, by the way...
Does either of those circuits have an equivalent of King versus Palmer?
Yes, it does. In fact, United States versus Thompson has its own King versus Palmer, which cites two King versus Palmer.
Since we're having an interesting discussion on that, if it's not Justice Sotomayor's opinion that governs, which one would?
If it's not Justice Sotomayor's, then... Freeman doesn't go away. It's still relevant to this court's decision, and this court would look to all three opinions.
We could pick. It's an open question.
It's an open question.
The Supreme Court said in these cases, like the Sixth Amendment cases, when there's no rationale at all, then we're free to do as we were before Freeman.
Exactly. Then we would be right back where we started. But we would still look to how did the justices analyze this question. The dissenters, as Your Honor's question suggested, would say there's a categorical bar. Justice Sotomayor would say you don't have either of the coordinates that are necessary for a guidelines calculation in the on the face of the agreement, so Mr. Duval doesn't qualify. And I agree with Judge Garland's suggestion in his question that even the plurality likely would not find that Mr. Duval was eligible, because here the applicable guideline range is in fact life imprisonment.
Well, two things about that. At least if we're following 5G11, it isn't the applicable guidelines range, it's the guideline sentence. And 5G11 seems to deliberately distinguish between those two. Second, you assume that the safety valve is inapplicable, and the 3582 judge's reasoning on that seems to me completely defective. He takes a warning issued by the sentencing judge. Well, you know, you face life if you would face life if you pled without the agreement, if I refused to follow the agreement. He never, he doesn't say, and you would get life. He says you face life, which face perhaps a risk of life. He never rules on 3553F, and under the circumstances was in no way called upon to rule on them, on that.
If I could answer the second question first, Judge Lamberth was both the sentencing judge and the reduction judge.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
And he said...
I see what Judge Robertson went on, did both the... Okay. Thank you.
And he told us, yes, I did in fact reject safety valve. What I did
was... Yeah, but the record doesn't sustain that.
Well, he calculated, in his statement of reasons, he calculated the guidelines range as life. And although he recited the PSR's calculation of 29, which itself included a two-level reduction for the safety valve, he himself calculated the guidelines range as life. And he told us in his memo opinion denying the reduction motion,
no.
I did reject that. As to the first...
He gives no explanation whatever.
Well, we're stuck with the record that we have, but I don't see any
reason. But I mean, we could look at the criteria provided by 3553F.
And the government opposed, specifically opposed in its papers, applicability of the safety valve. The government pointed out that although Mr. Duval had spoken with the government, he had not been completely truthful. So he would not, in fact, be eligible for the safety valve in any event. And that's one more reason to credit what Judge Lamberth said he did. If I could return to Your Honor's first question, the Sentencing Commission has answered this question for us. There is no doubt about it. In its 2011 amendments to the commentary to 1B1.10, 1B1.10 is the policy statement that governs...
The application note. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, 1B1.10 is the policy statement that is a governing policy statement for sentencing.
It triggers an application note. You're not relying on the application?
No, I am. I'm going to rely on the application note.
Yeah.
The commentary amends the application note to explain that the phrase applicable guideline range in 1B1.10 means the guideline range that corresponds to the offense level and criminal history category determined pursuant to 1B1.1A. If you turn to 1B1.1A, it has 8 subdivisions, the last of which directs the court to consider parts B through G of Chapter 5. Chapter 5, G1.B, provides that the statutory minimum, if that is greater than the applicable guideline range, shall be the guideline sentence.
It conspicuously doesn't say guideline range, right? In other words, these A, B, and C appear to draw a deliberate distinction between guideline sentence and guideline range. Now, I guess you could say that in the circumstances prevailing, where essentially the minimum trumps the range, you don't have a range, you have a number. So there's that argument, but they certainly does draw a distinction between range and sentence.
If you follow the Commission's own directive, and by the way, the commentary is, of course, Stinson Supreme Court has said that is the commentary itself is highly persuasive. If you follow the directives of the commentary tells you how to calculate what applicable guidelines range means. And in order to establish a applicable guidelines range, you must include 5G1.B. This interpretation also is the interpretation that this court has taken in Berry.
It's expressly what we said.
It's exactly what you said in Berry.
Yeah.
You anticipated...
Although it's a second step issue, it's as Berry points out, there are actually two steps, and so far we've been arguing about the first step.
Yes, Your Honor.
But it does define applicable guideline range as including the career offender range, after application of 5G.
But a lot of this is beside the point for your position, correct? What is the government's position stated succinctly on what must be in a plea agreement to fall within Justice Sotomayor's opinion?
The two essential coordinates of total offense level and criminal history category. This agreement had neither.
Okay. So you're with the Ninth Circuit and the First Circuit. I've read both those.
Yes, absolutely. Those cases govern this case if Your Honors agree that Justice...
That's where the government is,
yes,
on those things. So
absolutely,
that's the dividing line. If it does, even if it's obvious... I mean, that's the thing, and the question is how obvious is obvious. I think Justice Sotomayor uses evident and indicates as two of the words. And if it's within the range, we've had a lot of discussion about whether it would be within the range, but suppose it were obvious, clear, undisputed, that it was within the range and didn't say anything else, you would still say that's not good enough. Right?
Absolutely.
And I'm not, there is a
recent circuit case that I didn't bring to the court's attention, but I would be happy to do a 28J letter on that addresses that exact situation. The plea agreement
Still
says it's not good enough because parole evidence, under Justice Sotomayor's approach, parole evidence is not relevant to the determination. What you look to is the four corners of the agreement, and if the data points aren't there, then...
Well, but she didn't do that.
She did. She didn't infer any data points.
Yeah.
What she did was she took the data points that were there and applied the sentencing table to them.
Okay.
That's all she did.
But there were inferences drawn. It wasn't...
The inferences as to what the intent of the parties must have been based on the data that was on the face of the document. We don't have that data on the face of this document.
What inference was there other than, in that case, there was,
the inference was that they chose the sentence based on those data points.
Yes, but from the data points, there was no inference, there,
exactly.
Right? And she says, I believe that if a C agreement expressly uses a sentencing guideline range to establish the term of imprisonment. And then she says, when a C agreement expressly uses a guideline sentencing range to establish the term of imprisonment, and then somewhere else she's got, when a C agreement explicitly employs a particular sentencing range.
But there's also evident and indicates as two other verbs in there, right? The chief dissent points out the problem that that's going to create, and she is still there.
She says she doesn't.
You can't take the parole evidence of the chief's opinion to interpret.
No, but hers. we can take the evidence of that she left it in there, even though it was pointed out that this was different from expressly. So all the references to expressly are interesting, but not comprehensive, well, no, because it does say indicate and evident, which are different words than expressly.
But what is expressed?
Perhaps she didn't think it worth responding. You know, who knows why?
There was a lot of back and forth between those
indicate,
two opinions.
You would agree that expressly saying something is different from
it being evident or indicated.
Yeah,
absolutely.
The government would be a lot better off without the indicate or evidence. Yeah.
But what Justice Sotomayor, what she was firm on was that she was not looking outside the agreement for the data points. The data points were there. We don't have either of the data points here. We don't have criminal history category. Here, without criminal history category, 168 months falls within 11 different sentencing ranges. We don't have a total offense level. We have a reference to what would be a base offense level, but it is explicitly limited to being operative only if the court rejects the C agreement. So we don't have any basis for inferring from the data points in this agreement what the range was based on. And of course, the range that this was based on was life. The appellant pled guilty because he, quote, didn't want life. And even in the sentencing memo from Mr. Carney, he said, look, our guy is facing life, and we would like your honor to accept this C agreement because it gets him something less.
By the way, this is probably neither here nor there, but the district court made an error here in failing to calculate the guideline sentence, correct? I don't think it doesn't affect. You indicate this in footnote 32, I believe.
The district court did not, at the sentencing hearing, orally calculate it from the parties, but it did indicate.
You're supposed to do that, correct?
My understanding was that you're supposed to start every sentencing by correctly calculating the guidelines. The court made clear that it had reviewed the PSR, and it later adopted the PSR's calculation with the exceptions that it indicated. So I think that the court did, in fact, calculate the guidelines. It just didn't do it orally at the sentencing hearing.
Okay.
But it is neither here nor there because these are not full resentencings. I would quickly add, if Your Honors would permit me, If you decide to depart from all other the other six circuits that have said Sotomayor controls, this case is straightforwardly resolved by the second requirement of 3582C2, which is that the reduction must have the effect of lowering the applicable guideline range. And for this is the Berry analysis, and for the reasons that we've discussed, the crack cocaine reduction does not lower the mandatory statutory minimum.
Well, it's not clear. I mean, I'm sympathetic to that view since we already have Berry and we like to follow our previous opinion, so it's not clear what Justice Sotomayor would say about it because she relies more on the intent of the parties and the agreement of the parties.
Well, in fact,
and in that case, we rejected that as being relevant.
In fact, as the dissent points out in Freeman was limited solely to the first issue of based on.
It was, but if we're trying to guess what her analysis would be, and what at least four of the others' analysis would be, it's somewhat problematic. But I guess I think that you're right, that Berry continues until somebody tells us it doesn't.
Is the government then arguing in all the other circuits that the Justice Sotomayor position is controlling?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so from the government's position, that's a workable standard. I guess you'd follow it even if it weren't workable. And what are there any changes in practice that have been made that you can tell us about in terms of plea agreements since Freeman, or are you not aware of any?
Speaking of extra record information, our office has revised its standard plea agreements, C agreements, to reflect the
Which way?
to cut off any hope that the defendant will get any relief from...
Yes. Yes, because that is the intent of the C agreement.
Yeah.
That's the whole idea, is the parties have certainty as to a particular resolution. If there are no further questions?
Do you know if that's been done around the country in other U.S. attorney's offices?
I don't know that yet.
Okay, thank you. I know Ms. Royce doesn't have any more time, but that's our fault, not yours, so we'll give you another 2 minutes.
We would ask that you affirm.
Yeah, we got it. We got the idea.
I don't think the court needs to repudiate the Berry opinion at all. First of all, the Berry opinion speaks to a case in which the defendant was sentenced under as a career offender. Those of us who have spent most of our careers working with the sentencing guidelines find it very easy to forget that the mandatory minimums are entirely and totally separate from the career offender and the career offender guidelines. The mandatory minimums existed for decades before the sentencing guidelines do. All that has happened with the sentencing guidelines and their relationship with the mandatory minimum is that the mandatory minimum is going to trump the guidelines sentence in most cases. You have a situation here with Mr. Duvall in which the career offender guideline did not apply to him. It did not. It did apply to Berry, and therefore it was very clear how the Berry court decided that Mr. Berry was not entitled to a reduction in sentence. I'd also invite the court's opinion to the end of the first paragraph in Berry, in which in this 11C1C case, this court made it clear that a court must begin all proceedings by correctly calculating the applicable guidelines range. It was the law in this circuit, as well as the law of the Supreme Court, that this guideline range had to be calculated on the record. The adjustments that had been proposed in the pre-sentence report and disagreed over by the parties had to be resolved on the record. An applicable guideline range, or a guideline range, had to be calculated during the sentencing proceeding, and it was not. So that I think
you're
that...
You're not challenging the acceptance of the plea on that ground.
I'm sorry?
You're not challenging the plea's validity on that ground.
No, Your Honor, I'm not. But I think it's somewhat indicative of, if I may say so, the district court's somewhat conclusory approach to all of this, both at the sentencing, you know, to simply sit there and not calculate the guideline range, and then faced with a motion to reduce the sentence, to say at once, well, in the statement of reasons, you know, we have a guideline range at 34-1 and 29-1, but the guideline range is life. Well, the guideline range isn't life. That's simply not consistent with the plain language of the Sentencing Commission.
Under
what do you make of that?
Justice Sotomayor's view would, I mean, suppose here he'd calculated the guidelines range on the basis of the net final offense level of 29, and then he had said, well, but the parties have bargained in the face of the possible life sentence and have agreed on something higher outside that range. That would, in Sotomayor land, would that possibly be a sentence based on the guidelines range?
Well, I think it would be, because the relationship between the guidelines range would be very clear, the relationship between the sentence that's actually imposed and the relationship, the sentence that's actually imposed being the the one that is important for purposes of Sotomayor. I don't think it's important for purposes of Justice Sotomayor's opinion what the universe of other possibilities were.
No, but I'm sorry. The hypothetical you've produced, if I understand it correctly, is the sentencing judge does his duty and makes a, let's assume, correct finding of the applicable guidelines range, finds that we have the ultimate number is 29, and that produces a range under the 168. And then he, I guess, says, but I'll depart upward in light of various things. One can imagine identifying a range of things which justify departing upward. So then it all comes back to us under Justice Sotomayor's opinion. How do we find on that basis that the plea agreement is based on this guidelines range?
Oh, I see.
Which it seems not at all to be.
I think you're correct. I mean, that certainly isn't the case at bar, but I think you're correct that if the sentencing guideline range is correctly calculated and the district court judge goes through an analysis which includes a statement as to what the parties had bargained for and why they might have decided that that was an appropriate bargain, although the why is not really crucial, and says, I decided to impose the sentence that is that the parties have requested, that's probably correct. That probably would not really merit a reduction. I'd have to think about it a little bit more, but based upon the way Your Honor put the question to me, I think that's correct.
What do you think is the meaning of this new application note in 1B1.10? I guess I thought it was, maybe I'm wrong, is some kind of affirmation of the approach perhaps taken in Berry. But it's expressly about a statutory mandatory minimum.
We're looking here.
It's it's the application note to 1B1.10. It's application note 1A at large A.
I think for 1B1.10, I have only the 2009 version that. Okay, no, I'm sorry.
It's the one the government refers to in their discussion of the amendments. I think it's, there might even be a copy of it in the government's brief.
Perhaps if the court could read it to me, I could respond. I'm sorry, I don't
know. No, that's okay. I'm happy to read it, but it's a long.
Here, Mr. Spanish. Thank you. And
so it says, accordingly, this is application of subsection A, which is the application, which is the authorization to reduce if an amendment that does.
I'm sorry, is this under factors for consideration?
It's the first commentary. It says, I'll just read it. This is an application note to the authority to reduce. And it says, and the actual guideline, 1B1.10, says a reduction is not consistent with this policy statement, therefore not authorized if an amendment listed in subsection C does not have the effect of lowering the defendant's applicable guideline range. And then it said, and then the commentary says, accordingly, a reduction in the defendant's term of imprisonment is not authorized and not consistent with this policy if an amendment listed in subsection C is applicable to the defendant, but the amendment does not have the effect of lowering the defendant's applicable guideline range because of the operation of another guideline or statutory provision, e.g. a statutory mandatory minimum term of imprisonment. So I guess I was taking that as some kind of approval of what we similarly said with respect to Berry, which was even if the guideline range would have been reducible because the crack guidelines changed, the overall sentence isn't reducible because of the effect of another guideline, namely the one that requires that we apply the mandatory minimum. If you haven't thought about it, don't worry about it. This is not the way.
I haven't. I'm not sure my opinion would be worth anything here. I'd be glad to submit.
It would be, but it's not. It's not not necessary for the.
I'd be glad to submit additional briefing on that point if the court would like that.
It's not necessary. All right, we'll take the case under submission. Ms. Royce, you were appointed by the court to represent the appellant, and the court thanks you for your assistance, which, by the way, I thought was excellent.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that.
Thank the government. As always, your assistance is excellent.
Set.